It is perhaps a little bit odd to be preaching on this sort of theme on a day like Pentecost. Because Pentecost is all about new life. It's about celebrating the moment when God's Spirit came into the world and breathed that life into the first disciples and continues to breathe life into the church that gives us the courage to go and to tell people of Jesus Christ. It equips us, it gives us the words and the wisdom to know how and when to share the gospel. And yet, our theme today through this passage is death. Death is not an easy subject, nor should it be. Death is one of the most difficult experiences any of us will go through in terms of losing someone that we love. And I believe that death is hard because human beings were not created to die. Whether you believe in God or not, I am convinced that there is a small voice deep within us somewhere that just quietly says, it was never meant to be this way. Life was never meant to be this way. And that's why death is hard. Because on some level we think this was not the way our existence was meant to be. And so although there is perhaps this discord between the church calendar and our theme today, actually I think that as we take the time to reflect on what Paul is saying in this part of his letter, this is a very appropriate theme for a day like Pentecost. Because as so often happens with God, he takes something and turns it on its head. For you see, for the Christian, death is actually the way to new life. And so thinking of death on a day like Pentecost, well, that to me seems wholly appropriate as we think together about this new life. Oh, well, there you go. That's where we're going this morning. I only meant one of those to come up, but you've got all three. We start firstly by asking, well, what is the context of this? Why were the Thessalonians concerned about death? Why did Paul have to write to them about this? Well, we begin with Paul saying, firstly, that he does not want his brothers and sisters in the Thessalonian church to be uninformed about those who sleep in death. For you see, there was a certain expectation in the early church because Christ had ascended into heaven with the promise that one day he would return, and the expectation in the early church was that this return would be imminent, that it was going to be happening very, very soon. Indeed, some believed that they would see Christ return within their lifetime. And this impacted their ministry. It impacted the way that they shared the gospel. It fueled their urgency in sharing that gospel, and it galvanized their faith and their conduct. There was the thought, well, if Jesus is going to come back at any moment, we'd better be ready for him. But as time passed, this expectation of Jesus' imminent return was being challenged and eroded because he wasn't coming back. And this challenge got all the more difficult when believers started to die. People were asking, well, what's going to happen now? We expected Christ to come back before any of us even tasted death. What on earth is going on here? And so Paul has to write to the Thessalonians to address this concern. Now, we today are still waiting for Christ's return. In fact, I have said before, the Bible's promises have more or less been fulfilled, bar one. The promise of Christ's return, which is pretty good, I have to say. in terms of keeping promises if there's only one outstanding one. But of course, that means that we can expect, therefore, that at some point Christ will return. However, I wonder if in the church today we need to recapture something of the urgency of the early church. Jesus himself, commenting on his return, says in Matthew 25, "Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour." That's the New International Version, but the New Living Translation of that same verse puts it even more clearly. "Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or hour of my return." We do not know when Christ is going to come back. It could happen before I have finished this sermon. But in his absence, I wonder if the church has reached a point where we think, well, he's not back yet, and he's not been back for a while, so, you know, we can take our time. We can be relaxed, and mañana, mañana, you know, oh, it'll happen when it happens. And that's why the church is in decline. Because we've lost that urgency and that sense of we have a message and we have to get it out before Christ comes back. I think we need to recapture something of that urgency in terms of our faith and our evangelism and our conduct. Because the reality is, yes, Christ hasn't returned yet, but it could be at any moment. And if we are living and believing and sharing our faith, believing that it could be at any moment, that will change how we do it. We won't be relaxed and complacent. We'll be urgent. Paul also writes to the Thessalonians that he is addressing this issue, not just to inform them of the facts, but also so that they do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. Now, the first thing I would point out here is that notice Paul does not say Christians should not grieve. He doesn't say that. There are some that do. If Christians believe what they do, then they shouldn't grieve. Well, anybody that says that either misunderstands the Christian faith or has never experienced death. Just because we believe in Jesus doesn't mean that we do not grieve when someone dies. Because even although we have faith, death is still hard. I've already said why I believe that death is the hardest thing any of us can face. So we are well at liberty to grieve. But Paul makes it clear that we, as Christians, our grief is different from the grief of the rest of the world who have no hope. If you believe that this life in this world is all there is, then for you, death is a catastrophe. Because not only are you grieving the fact that a person is no longer a resident of this earth, you are grieving the fact that they are gone and lost for eternity and beyond. If there is nothing more to life than this world, then when we die, that's the end. All that we have left is history, and history only tends to record the lives of the more famous people. That is what it means to grieve if you have no hope. But Paul makes a distinction. He says, Christians, you grieve, yes, but you do have hope. You have a hope that you can hold on to and that can help you as you deal with your grief. There is a distinction. And that distinction is what Paul goes on to explain. That hope is what Paul goes on to explain in the next few verses. He begins in verses 14 to 15 by explaining to the Thessalonians and to us what the Christian experience of death is. Let me ask you a question. This is not a rhetorical question. I'm looking for an answer. What happens to Christians when they die? Yes, Bill. We go to heaven. Bill, could you tell me where in the Bible it says that we go to heaven?
I'm not sure it says anywhere.
You're correct. There's an assumption. The answer we give, what happens to Christians when we die? Oh, we go to heaven. The Bible doesn't say that. There's a line in one of the praise gathering songs this year. When we all go to heaven. When we learned that song, Ruth sent me a message saying, are you twitching? I said, yes, I am a bit, because that's not correct. This is a bit of one of my go-to issues, I think, so that's why she knew. The Bible does not say that Christians go to heaven. In fact, the Bible is quite clear that we don't. The Bible explains that the way that the universe is created, the heavens are the dwelling place of God, and the earth is where humanity was to live. And in Genesis, the image we have is the God of heaven coming down and being with the people on the earth. Heaven is the residing place of God and the heavenly hosts, the angels and all of those things. We don't go there. That is where God is. We do not go there. Where we go is answered by Jesus himself. In his crucifixion, he was hanging on the cross. One of the criminals said to him, my Lord, would you remember me when you come into your kingdom? And Jesus replied, truly I tell you, today you will be with me in, not heaven, in paradise. You will be with me in paradise. Now, Jesus didn't say to this chap, upon the resurrection, you'll be with me in paradise. He said, today. And so in that moment, Jesus is explaining exactly what happens upon death. Immediately, we go to paradise. And Paul, in this letter, begins to explain to us what paradise is for the Christian. He talks about those who have fallen asleep in the Lord, those who have fallen asleep in death. That, I do not think, is simply a simile or a metaphor. I think Paul, inspired by the Spirit, was telling us very specifically and literally what death is. It is sleep in the Lord. And the reason I think that sleeping in the Lord is like paradise is because, and those of you who are older than I will be able to attest to this, life in all of its brokenness and sickness and sinfulness becomes wearying. Life in this world is not easy. And so when we reach to that point where our weary lives in this sinful world are ended, for us we receive the respite and rest of God's presence. That is what makes this paradise. It is that big sigh of relief that you experience when at the end of the busiest day you have ever had, you finally crawl into your bed. But because this is rest with God, it is beyond that blissful experience of sleep in this world. And it is not something that we fear. Under normal circumstances, nobody is afraid of going to bed. In fact, some of us look forward to it. Some of us go through our day waiting for the moment when we can justifiably pull the duvet over and go to sleep for another night. We don't fear it. And for Christians, the experience of death is nothing more unsettling than pulling over that duvet and going to sleep. We do not fear it because, again, under normal circumstances, when we go to sleep, we expect to wake up again. When I go to bed, I expect, if I've done it properly, that my alarm will go off at the time I've set it for, and that I'll wake up. I go to bed expecting that I will rise on the following day, or often the same day. It's the same for when we receive this blissful rest in paradise, in God's presence. We who die in God, we go to this place of rest. It is not a place we fear. It is a place where our spirits go to finally receive that rest and respite we need, having lived our wearying lives in this world. But we go there fully expecting that at some point that God has appointed, we will wake up. We will wake up. And Paul affirms that in this letter. Just as Jesus died and rose again, he explains in verse 14, so will we. We affirm that what is true of Jesus becomes true of us. Now, Jesus himself experienced death, and his was a lot more violent and unsettling than I hope that ours will be. We can give thanks that for many of us, death is simply slipping into that sleep. But for Christ, it was a violent experience. But he still slipped into that sleep of death. And then 3 days later, he rose again. And Jesus didn't rise in some sort of spiritual, mystical sense. He rose and his disciples were able to touch him. And his friends were able to recognize him. And while his body was clearly regenerated and he had the ability to do things that he couldn't previously, before his death and resurrection, for example, Jesus didn't appear and disappear at will. Although it was a new body and a regenerated body with new abilities, he was still very much recognizable as, oh, you're Jesus. And so the same will be true of us. When we rise to this new life, it is not a spiritual, mystical thing. It is a real flesh and blood experience. God grants us new bodies. We don't know what they will be like. We don't know if we will have abilities beyond that which we already have. I certainly hope that my resurrection body will be a little less chubby around the middle. But what will not change between this body and the one that I will receive is that when we meet in the new creation, you'll be able to say, ah, you were that minister at Clinkert Hill. And I'll say, oh yes, I remember you from the congregation. We will recognize one another. The Bible talks that in one of the Psalms, we are each fearfully and wonderfully made. We are unique people, and that will not change at the resurrection. We don't quite know how it will all work. In some ways, we don't have to. All we know is that we affirm and believe that the experience of death for the Christian begins with resting in God's presence and ends with resurrection to new physical life. And that place will be, and it talks about this in Revelation, the new heavens and the new earth. And this is where we see this distinction between heaven and earth made. Because Revelation doesn't say that we'll all live on the clouds in the new heaven. It says specifically that God will get rid of the old sinful creation and create the new heavens and the new earth. And in Revelation, John, in his vision, sees this picture of a new Jerusalem, a new holy city of God, descending from heaven down into the new earth. The image being that God's dwelling place with humanity is now firmly established on the new earth, never to go again. And we will live in the new earth as part of this new creation. The sin, the sadness, the sickness, all of the troubles of this world are over. We live for eternity with one another, with God, and in the way that he always intended. He never intended us to experience death. And in the new creation, there will be no more death. And we will live and we'll say, yes, this was the way it was always meant to be. And because we're finally living the way God always meant it to be, never again will any of us ever entertain the notion of sinning against God, because it was sin that caused all the problems. Having lived in the sinful world and now receiving the perfect world, no one will be able to entertain the idea of going back. And so for eternity, it will be perfect as God intended. All of this will occur upon Christ's return. And that is the third point in our passage this morning, the Christian experience of Christ's return. Paul describes that Jesus will come from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of an archangel and the trumpet of God. In other words, this will be an experience like no other. But it will also be undeniable. A loud voice, a loud command, voice of an archangel, trumpet, call of God. This will be unmissable, undeniable. Nobody will miss Christ's return. And all of God's faithful, whether alive or being raised from the dead, they are, Paul describes, caught up in the clouds to meet him. This single phrase, caught up in the clouds to meet him, has given rise to some of the strangest false teaching I think I've ever come across. And I have to share it with you, just in case any of you ever encounter this, because it is false teaching. There are some that argue that at this point of Christ's return, Christians will literally be lifted from the earth. And this is known as the rapture. After this rapture has taken place, the earth experiences years of tribulation. The exact number is not agreed upon, but there's years of tribulation before Christ finally returns and the rest of what we've described comes to pass. Now, that teaching about Christians going away in general carnage on the earth, that makes for a good fictional series of books or movies, but it's poor theology. Because other than taking this one verse in 1 Thessalonians exceptionally literally, you won't find it anywhere else in the Bible. Even some of the more imaginative parts of Revelation where we really struggle to understand what John is seeing, even there, you will not find evidence of the rapture. So how then are we to interpret this verse if it's not about us being literally lifted into the clouds? Well, Tom Wright, as many of you will have gathered by now, he's one of my favorite theologians and authors. He helps explain this verse to us. He says the key is to realize what resurrection itself means. It does not mean disembodied life in some mid-air heaven, but the re-embodiment of God's people to live with and for God in the new redeemed world that God will make. It would therefore be nonsense to imagine that the presently alive Christians are literally going to be snatched up into the sky, there to remain forever. How would they be with the others who, having died previously, will be raised and given new bodies? So when Paul talks of Christians being snatched up among the clouds, he is not thinking of a literal vertical ascent. The language here is taken from Daniel 7, where one like the Son of Man goes up on the clouds as he is vindicated by God after his suffering. A wonderful image, not least for people like the Thessalonians who were suffering persecution and waiting and awaiting God's vindication. And their meeting with the Lord doesn't mean that they will be staying in the midair with him. They are like Roman citizens in a colony going to meet the emperor when he pays them a state visit and then accompanying him back to the city itself. It's that last sentence that is the key. At the time when Paul wrote this, if there was a visiting dignitary coming to your town or city, the protocol was that you all went to meet them outside of the town and then walked with them back into the town. It would be like, for example, if you were in Windsor yesterday you would go out of the town of Windsor to meet the royal party, and you would walk with them back into the town in order for there to be some kind of event. I don't know. I had other things in my mind yesterday. So when we read of this in terms of Jesus, what I imagine is something like this, and forgive me, this is only my imagination. But upon Christ's return, there will be an undeniable sign. There will be a call that we will all recognize. Instinctively, we'll say, that's Jesus, he's back. And from wherever that call has come from, we will be compelled to go to meet him. So drawn will we be to him that we will just have to drop whatever we are doing and we will go to meet Jesus. And having gone to meet him, wherever he is coming from, we walk back with him into not this world, but the new world. The undeniable call of Jesus' return, we go to it. The dead are raised. God's judgment comes, his righteous judgment. Those who are faithful receive the resurrection to new life, are granted these new bodies. Those who do not believe, unfortunately, are not part of that company. And then, like the people returning to the city with the dignitary, we return to the new earth with our Savior and Lord. And there we live for eternity in that perfect place. And of course, some of you may say, well, isn't the new earth going to get a little bit boring after all of eternity? Well, perhaps it might, but that's why God has given us a whole universe. It would take eternity for us to begin to understand the universe at the moment. Imagine actually being given eternity by God and a whole universe. And he says, this is my creation for you. It is perfect in every way. Go and enjoy it, and enjoy me. We need to recapture something of the urgency of the early church. To be part of the new creation that we have described and explored this morning, we must believe that Jesus has taken our sin and forgiven us. Only then will we pass through God's righteous judgment and receive new life, a new body, and live in the new creation. We must therefore believe in Christ before his return, because by then it will be too late. And we do not know when he will come back. Let we who believe therefore urgently share the gospel. Tell people of this hope. Tell people of this new creation and plead with them. Believe in Jesus that you too may receive this hope that comes from dying in God. For we who already believe, we have hope today, and the return of Christ is a wonderful prospect. It means that there will be an end to suffering and sin. It means that there is new life beyond death. There is a new creation, a new heavens, a new earth. And we will get to live there with each other, with Christ, with God. We will live in the way that God always intended for us. This hope that we have for life beyond death, it is why, for the Christian, death is not something to be feared. Yes, we still grieve, as we should, but we also give thanks, for we will see those who die again in the new creation. I want to leave you with this quote from Tom Wright. Paul's point is that we can be confident in God's future purposes for those Christians who have died. There will be grief, of course, but there is also hope. There will come a day when God will put all wrongs to right, when all grief will turn to joy. Jesus will be central to that day, which will end with the unveiling of God's new world. There, those who have already died and those who are still alive will both alike be given renewed bodies to serve God joyfully in his new creation. Thanks be to God. Amen.